You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The climate may be heating up, but Nobel Prize-winning physicist Burton Richter tries to avoid heated rhetoric in his book Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, Climate Change and Energy in the 21st Century. His stated goal is to demystify the climate change debate for the average American using scientific detachment and carefully placed observations. His book is published by Cambridge University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Burton Richter to our show today. Hello. Does the debate over climate change come into the realm of physicists?
The problem comes into the realm of physicists, atmospheric scientists, chemists, all sorts of things.
Well, you also have international politics here, public policy, economics.
Everything. But the public is stuck between two groups. I like to call them the deniers and the exaggerators. The deniers say that it's all sort of a big fraud, and the exaggerators say that it's such a terrible problem that if we don't throw everything at it immediately, the world will come to an end tomorrow.
But you include Al Gore in the climate change exaggerated category. Why Al Gore? He seems to be rather reasoned.
In the introduction, I compliment Al Gore because I thought Al Gore, his first book, did a terrific job of waking up the public to the problem. On what he's saying now about what to do about it, I think Al Gore is exaggerating the scale of immediate action that's required to do something about this.
And we have others like Bill McKibben, the environmental author, NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who say we already have more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere than the Earth can handle, and immediate, drastic action is necessary. You're saying they're exaggerating?
You like to pin people down. What do I mean when I say they're exaggerating? What I mean when I say that there
is... If I don't pin you down,
That's,
we have a very nice,
you're a
friendly,
very good interviewer
soft.
Already. So what I mean is that there are a lot of things that we can do now that can have a big impact, and we should be doing the sensible things instead of the things which are not sensible. Science and technology changes. I don't know what we're going to be doing for our energy sources 50 years from now, and neither do they. But I can do more by taking one coal-fired power plant, a big one, and converting it to natural gas than the million solar roofs that Governor Schwarzenegger wants to cover with solar cells in California. So why should I go spend 10 times as much to do the solar cells when I do twice as much to reduce greenhouse gases at a fraction of the total cost?
Well, I want to get into the details of that in a little while, but let's stick with the basics, some climate science basics. How do you define the greenhouse effect? Is it pretty much agreed upon by everybody?
There is no exception here. All scientists agree that the greenhouse effect is real. If you turn off the greenhouse effect, if I could magically do that, the average temperature of the Earth would be 5 degrees below zero. We would be a frozen ball of slush. Average temperature of the Earth is 60 degrees above zero. That's a greenhouse effect. Now,
I mean, that's a normal and one that we like because that allows for Earth to be inhabited.
That's right. But it's the greenhouse effect, and nobody argues that the greenhouse effect is not real. What the deniers are saying is that human activity is not really responsible for the increase in temperature we've seen in the last 100 years, that it's a natural process, and because it's a natural process, we can't do anything about it.
What can we learn from Venus and Mars about the necessity of the Earth's atmosphere for sustaining life as we know it?
You know, I like to tell the tale of three planets. Here we are. Venus, if I turned off the greenhouse effect, the average temperature of Venus would be 90 degrees, and the poles would be quite comfortable, but the average temperature of Venus is 700 degrees. It has a greenhouse effect gone crazy.
I thought it was just that it was closer to the sun.
No.
Is it hotter than Mercury, which is closer to the sun?
I don't know the answer to that, but remember what I said. I turned off the greenhouse effect, and the Earth, if I turned it off, it'd be 5 degrees below zero, and Venus, it's 90 degrees above zero. That's because it's closer to the sun. Mars. If I turned off, Mars has no greenhouse effect now because it doesn't have an atmosphere, and Mars's temperature is 60 degrees below zero. But Mars once had liquid water, and to have liquid water, it had an atmosphere and it had a greenhouse effect. Mars is sufficiently small so that the gravity isn't strong enough to hold the atmosphere. It drifted away, and with it, the greenhouse effect, and the temperature plunged, and Mars is now a cold desert.
We are approaching this problem with a reliance on computers and computer climate modeling. I guess computers are the way we're going to approach everything. How does it work in this case?
Let me say that the modeling started before there were computers. The first really decent job was done in the late 1890s.
Were they already talking about global warming then?
A Swedish scientist decided to try and figure out what would happen if he doubled or halved the carbon dioxide. The question was the ice ages, what caused them. Mm-hmm. So if you cut it in half, he found the temperature went down 5 degrees centigrade. That's more than the Fahrenheit thing. And if you doubled it, it went up. The 5 degrees down was consistent with what you saw in the ice ages. He and his colleagues even tried to figure out how long it would take to double things in on the Earth. But back then, the population was smaller, life expectancy was shorter, and they figured it would take 1,000 years. And if it was going to be 1,000 years, let's not worry about it now. Things will change a lot. They did not envisage, nobody did, the public health revolution that made life expectancy longer, that sent the population up, the economic growth that came with it. And 1,000 years turned into 100 years. And here we are.
All sorts of things have happened as well. Of course, they couldn't have imagined that we would be relying on fossil fuels the way we are, that we would have so many domesticated animals, all of this adding to the problem.
Yes, but the biggest part of the problem is the fossil fuel problem. If you look at the analyses, it's about 70% of the problem. There's 30% of the problem, which is really very difficult, and that is related to agriculture and land use changes. That one's going to be hard to do. It's much easier to do something about the fossil fuels.
My guest is Dr. Burton Richter, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1976. He has written a book called Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, Climate Change and Energy in the 21st Century. It is published by Cambridge University Press. And I wonder if you were amused at all by the fact that Ian McEwan has written a book about a Nobel Prize winner who also comes up with a plan, or steals a plan in his case, for addressing climate change.
I thought he was a bad guy.
He is a bad guy.
I thought he was a villain. I'm trying to be a hero.
Well, what are your thoughts about ClimateGate? Every time I get an email from a denier, they bring this up.
I think that the science community did an absolutely rotten job of dealing with ClimateGate. The first reaction of everybody was, oh, those mean, nasty people stealing all that email. It wasn't to deal with the accusations that data was being suppressed. What they accused the East Anglia people of doing was a serious scientific sin, and that's throwing out data because they didn't like it. There have been several investigations going on. The latest is one from the Royal Society. That's their equivalent of our National Academy of Sciences. And that one says that, in fact, East Anglia did not suppress the data. They had a lot of emails back and forth talking about, wouldn't it be nice to do this? And that the data on tree rings, in fact, had no real influence on the analysis anyway. There's a third investigation that's still going on. And I haven't read that one yet, but the Royal Society says that it's not what was alleged. And the people they brought in were outsiders. There was one American and four Brits on that committee.
Isn't part of the problem that the public doesn't really understand the scientific process and the role of uncertainty in it?
I don't think that's the problem. One of the things I deal with in this book is both what we know, how we know it, what the uuncertainties are, why the uncertainties exist, and how long it's going to take.
And when it comes to solving the climate crisis, you say there are winners, losers, and maybes. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can go through a few of those. You mentioned earlier natural gas as a replacement for coal-fired power plants. You don't think that we need the new grid that was included in the economic stimulus package?
There are several new grids, and people get confused about what they're talking about. In fact, there are three of them. One of them is, let's modernize the grid so we no longer have a blackout like happened in the Northeast. Another one
you
is...
You like let, that?
Hmm?
Do you think
that's very sensible. Mm-hmm. The other one is to modify the grid so you can get energy from the Great Plains wind farms to where it's needed. And the third one is the one that's getting most of the money. That's the one to modify the local grid with these so-called smart meters. And the smart meters allow pricing of electricity to change hour by hour, and it's supposed to give you incentives to change your consumption. But what happens if you're not home when they want to change the price? What do you do about it? I think that one's getting more attention than it ought to get. A simpler version would do things just as well. The other two are very important and should be getting first attention rather than second and third.
You mentioned earlier you're not a fan of fuel cells. Why?
Fuel cells, as of now, are not practical for use on a large scale. For example, fuel cells that are used in hydrogen-powered cars use so much platinum that there isn't enough platinum produced in the entire world to build 10 million fuel cells a year. 10 million cars a year is less than we produce in the United States alone. Fuel cells may be good, but they need to go back to the laboratory. They need to go back to get improved catalysts, improved efficiency, and longer lifetime.
And solar panels, you also object to them. Is it because they're too expensive to produce efficiently?
Solar panels, I think, have a potential. They're getting subsidized to come down the learning curve. But frankly, nobody would install solar panels without the subsidies, and nobody would buy their electricity unless the utilities were forced to. The electricity price is five times too much. I don't object to subsidizing solar panels to see if they come down the learning curve. We know that some of them are, and some of them have stopped coming down the learning curve.
Mostly being done in Germany with German government subsidies.
No, there are a lot of them being done here, and even more being done in China with Chinese government subsidies. But we should be pushing the ones that still show promise and not pushing the ones that seem to have stalled out.
What about ethanol? There's corn and there's sugar ethanol.
I'm sorry, I laugh. Corn ethanol is a political tool to get the votes of the Corn Belt. It has nothing to do with greenhouse gases. All the analyses show that if you include land use changes, corn ethanol is slightly worse than gasoline. Sugarcane ethanol is a different story, and the reason is that the sugarcane plant is much more efficient at turning sunlight into sugar. So there, if you make ethanol from that, you end up with less greenhouse gas emissions.
Although we just recently did a report on sugar ethanol in Brazil, and the production of sugar, the growing production of sugar, is destroying the environment there for all sorts of other reasons. So it may be a mixed blessing as well.
It may be. I'm talking about the greenhouse part. Now, the part that I've looked at is the region in Brazil where the sugarcane is grown. The Brazilians are not pulling down the rainforest to expand the range of sugarcane. If they did, it would be really bad environmental news. But what they are doing makes a lot more sense than corn ethanol, which to me makes no sense at all. It's not to say that ethanol produced by what I call the second and third generation methods isn't going to be a winner, but those things are still in the laboratory. They haven't been tried at scale. We don't know if they're going to work.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back and talk about wind and talk about nuclear power and more as we continue this conversation with Burton Richter. His book, Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, Climate Change and Energy in the 21st Century, published by Cambridge University Press. Stay with us. We're back with Dr. Burton Richter, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1976. He's written a book about the current climate change problem called Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, Climate Change and Energy in the 21st Century, published by Cambridge University Press. You are somebody who believes strongly in nuclear power. But before we get to that, what about wind? We've dismissed solar, at least for the moment. Is wind a problem as well?
Let me make myself a little bit clearer than I have now. I don't dismiss solar. I think solar really needs some work to get it to the point where it's cost effective. There are other ways of reducing greenhouse gases that are better, and you just picked one of them, wind. Wind is a lot better than solar because the energy you produce from wind is cheaper than solar.
One of the problems with wind is a lot of people don't want those windmills in their backyards.
That's a different problem. But let me go on with wind, because wind does have a problem, and the problem is its intermittency. So the question is, how do you back it up, and how do you deliver it? Biggest wind thing on land in the United States is the Great Plains. There's not a hell of a lot of our industry or people in the Great Plains. So we need an enhanced grid to deliver that. The other thing about wind is that it is highly variable. So since it's highly variable, it has to be backed up. And at the moment, we don't have the infrastructure to have wind as big as people would like to see it. If you got 10%, 15% of your electricity from wind, that's a big effect, and we do have the ways to back that up. You've got to back it up with natural gas. It's the only effective way today.
I spoke to somebody who worked on the windmills outside, who worked in the windmills in the desert in California, and he said that they put motors in them to keep them going during slow periods, but the motors would burn out when the windmills went around fast, and so it actually wound up costing a lot more money than if they just simply let them lie dormant when there was no wind.
Now that's what they do. It's like the old propeller airplane days when I think most of the audience is too young to know about feathering a propeller, turning the blades so that they're edge on to the wind.
Let's talk about nuclear power, which is the most controversial
yes.
of them all. Beyond the regular arguments, isn't there another problem that it requires government subsidies just as all of the other things that are considered uneconomic do?
I don't think it needs government subsidies. It certainly doesn't get government subsidies in many of the other countries that do it. What nuclear power needs now from a government is loan guarantees. We have a history of delays, regulatory delays, interventions by environmental groups, construction delays, all sorts of things, and those run the cost way up. The loan guarantees are supposed to give the finance community security enough to put a reasonable interest rate. You put a reasonable interest rate on, and nuclear power can compete with anything. If you look at the analyses that have been done by the National Academy of Sciences, the Department of Energy, the MIT Energy Group, they all give you the same thing, that if you don't put any constraints on carbon emissions, electricity from nuclear power with new plants will be about 20% more expensive than coal. But if you start putting a cap and trade and other such things, coal prices are going to go up and nuclear will be quite competitive. And if you look at South Korea, you look at Japan, you look at China, nuclear is doing fine, thank you.
Well, you studied the French nuclear program.
Yes, they have the cheapest electricity in Europe, and they have 80% of it coming from nuclear power.
What are they doing to deal with the life cycle costs of nuclear and the problem of what to do with the spent fuel that has been the major stumbling block here?
I like to say that although the French are advertised to be a very emotional people, in fact, in this issue, they're a lot more rational than we are. They have had a program for some time of dealing with this. They have a system where there is a joint committee of both houses of their parliament that takes on technical issues. They passed a law that said, nuclear industry, you've got, I think it was 15 years to deliver us a solution for spent fuel. If you don't do it, we're going to shut you down. I testified at a hearing on that program several years ago. They came up with a solution, and the solution is I call it a highway to solving the problem with several off-ramps. You can bury it in a Yucca Mountain-like thing. The soil is different in France, and so it's easier to do it than it was at Yucca Mountain. The other thing you can do is you can try and take the long-lived part and burn it up in a new kind of nuclear reactor, and they're going to have the first of the new kind available in 20 years to try and see how this works. And then they're going to decide which they're going to do. Are they going to go bury it, or are they going to go recycle it and get rid of it? You can't get rid of it all, but if you got rid of these very long-lived things, you'd only have to put it away for 400 or 500 years, and the Egyptians could build pyramids that lasted 5,000. I don't think anybody should worry about 400 or 500.
Some might argue that you're pro-nuclear power because you're a physicist, in the same way that a surgeon usually sees surgery as the best option to any problem.
I like to think I'm pro-nuclear power because I'm a rational scientist.
My guest is Burton Richter, whose book, Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, Climate Change and Energy in the 21st Century, is published by Cambridge University Press. I assume you've been following the climate bill in the House and Senate.
Yeah, can I say one more thing about nuclear before we go on to the climate bill? People are afraid of radiation, but people don't realize that everybody is radioactive, and they're radioactive because it's a very long isotope of potassium that was built into our planet 4.5 billion years ago, and everybody's bones have that potassium in it, and everybody gets 10,000 times more radiation from the potassium in their own bones than they get from a properly operating nuclear power plant.
Well, you say properly operated. Of course, we had Chernobyl, and we've had Three Mile Island, and there have been
other. They're very different, very different. We didn't allow Chernobyl-style reactors in the United States or Europe, and the reason, because Chernobyl reactors could go unstable. They were forbidden here. And we had Three Mile Island, where the core of the reactor actually melted down. Our requirements are a containment building, and the largest radiation dose anybody got from Three Mile Island was less than half of what you get naturally per year from all the things in our environment.
Well, things have changed in our attitudes about radiation over the years in a lot of different ways. When I was a kid, I used to go to a Tom McCann store, and they would put my feet on this X-ray machine to see how my bones.
And you'd wiggle your toes, and you'd watch the move in the front of the shoe. I did the same thing.
And I think back at that, I think, were we crazy?
Were we crazy? Yes. We didn't know as much. Remember those people that used to paint luminous dials on wristwatches back in the 1910s and 1920s. Mm-hmm. When radium was first discovered, it was a miracle.
It could glow in the dark.
It could glow in the dark. It could be used to see through things. Radiation was supposed to be good for you.
Let's get to the to Congress and this energy bill. The latest news suggests that it may not be as easy to get passed as was thought, now that Lindsey Graham has withdrawn his support for reasons that have to do with the way the Senate is run. But what have the lawmakers gotten right, and what have they gotten wrong as far as you're concerned?
As nobody's seen this, the Kerry, Graham, and Lieberman bill, but there are a lot of rumors about what's in it, and I like the rumors about it. It is much less complicated than the Waxman-Markey bill that came out of the House. They do things in a much simpler way. They say, let's start with the biggest single problem and the easiest one to treat, and that is emission from electricity generation. So their cap and trade focuses on electricity generation. For vehicles, what they do is they're going to take the average price of carbon and the cap and trade thing, and they're going to impose that as an extra fee on gasoline to discourage that use. The hardest problem is industry, because industry is so varied. You've got to regulate steel mills to pharmaceutical companies to oil refineries, and they're all different. They postpone that one. They give sort of an extra 6 years to figure out how to bring them in. I think that bill, if it came to the floor, is better than the Waxman-Markey because it's a lot simpler, and it gives us time to learn how to do this job and to do it right, and it gets us that time by tackling the biggest and easiest one first. And I just hope Senator Graham changes his mind.
You suggest that some cap and trade is better than others and that it could make the inefficient wealthy and the efficient poor.
If you do cap and trade and give away the allowances, you're heading for trouble. I always preferred an emission fee known as a carbon tax. I can get you conservative economists who will say the same thing as long as you give the money back. But we're on this cap-and-trade route, and let's do it and do it right and make it work and try and see that the inefficient don't.
What's the current status of carbon capture and sequestration, or so-called clean coal?
It hasn't been done on a scale yet required for power plants. We do something like it in enhanced oil recovery where people pump carbon dioxide down underground to push more oil out. It's done by the Norwegians. There's a particular offshore gas field that has a lot of carbon dioxide in the gas. They separate it right at the platform and then pump the carbon dioxide back up and underground. But that's not done at the scale required.
Now, that's storing carbon dioxide in the ocean bed?
No, it's storing it in the rock underneath the ocean.
And will it just stay there?
Supposed to. That's the big issue. Are these things going to leak? That's what a lot of research is going on now, and that research is going to have to be followed by large-scale tests. And then we're going to have to deal with the particular American problem of litigiousness. Who's responsible 100 years from now? Industry can't take that problem on. Some states say that the state will be responsible if it lasts for 50 years and we take over the responsibility for longer. I don't know what's going to happen.
But I've always wondered, why do we don't just build those possibilities into the legislation? You know, if in 100 years such and such happens, this is our plan. Instead of, we have the oil spill, everybody says it's not my fault, and then 50 years later, we have a situation in Greenpoint where somebody's going to have to clean up the worst oil spill in North American history.
In the United States, what you do underground is regulated by the states. And so we have 50 separate regulatory things. Yes, the feds can intervene and make a national program. But at the moment, it is the state land commissions, the state public utilities commissions. Those are the people that set the rules for what happens when you pump things underground or pump things out from underground.
What do you think of the Obama administration's decision to revive the FutureGen project?
FutureGen is something that is supposed to try this thing at an appropriate scale, and it involves two main things. One is separating the carbon dioxide from the gases coming out of the power plant, and the other is to pump it underground and put it away. There was a third piece to FutureGen, which I believe they've dropped, and that was to use the plant to produce hydrogen, which I always thought was asking too much for an experimental plant.
You say that the upper limit for carbon in the atmosphere should be 550 parts per million, twice pre-industrial levels. First of all, what does the science tell us that life will be like and how hot it will be when we hit that mark?
I could give you the numbers from the IPCC. They would be about, if I remember it right, at the average prediction's about 2.5 degrees centigrade. That's 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And the high is 7 degrees and the low is 2. This is one of these questions of what is the range of predictions and how are we going to narrow that range? There's a lot of talk about trying to hold it to 450 parts per million. It's impossible. We're already almost there. And, you know, you shouldn't set goals that you can't reach.
So what do you think is the most important message the public and policymakers should take away from your book, that it's impossible to reach the goals that we feel we must reach?
No. I thought, in fact, that my book was just exactly the opposite. It was optimistic about doing it, and it says what we need is sensible policies, not nonsensical policies. And I describe what I would be doing to start. As I said earlier, I don't know what we should be doing 50 years from now. We'll find out 50 years from now. But the big industrialized countries have got to make a fast start. The most difficult question is bringing in the developing world. Now, I told you I was an optimist, and everybody says this Copenhagen meeting was a big failure. I don't think so. For the first time ever, China and India said they have to be part of a control regime. They didn't say how much, but they had never said, we have to be in this too. That's a huge positive step. And we're going to have a system where, at least at the beginning, the industrialized nations cut emissions faster. The developing nations are going to have to grow their economies, but they have to reduce the rate that emissions grow, and eventually we're all going to have to join in this mode where we cut the emissions together. I'm not a pessimist. I'm an optimist, and I'd be even more optimistic if we chose sensible options instead of dumb ones.
Burton Richter's book, Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, Climate Change and Energy in the 21st Century, is published by Cambridge University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.